Randu, said Fran, looking at his brother like a great helpless bull. Randu took his pipe away from his lips. The boy's right, Fran. When you listen to the little thoughts deep inside you, you know he is. But they're uncomfortable thoughts, so you drown them out with that roar of yours. But they're still there. Toran, I'll tell you why I brought all this up. He puffed thoughtfully a while, then dipped his pipe into the neck of the tray, waited for the silent flash, and withdrew it clean. Slowly he filled it again with precise tamps of his little finger. He said, Your little suggestion of Foundation's interest in us, Toran, is to the point. There have been two recent visits lately, for tax purposes. The disturbing point is that the second visitor was accompanied by a light patrol ship. They landed in Glyar City, giving us the miss for a change, and they never lifted off again, naturally. But now they'll surely be back. Your father is aware of all this, Toran. He really is. Look at the stubborn Raquel. He knows Haven is in trouble, and he knows we're helpless, but he repeats his formulas. It warms and protects him. But once he's had his say and roared his defiance, and feels he's discharged his duty as a man and a bull trader, why, he's as reasonable as any of us. Any of who? Asked Beta. He smiled at her. We've formed a little group, Beta, just in our city. We haven't done anything yet. We haven't even managed to contact the other cities yet, but it's a start. But towards what? Randu shook his head. We don't know yet. We hope for a miracle. We have decided that, as you say, a Selden crisis must be at hand. He gestured widely upwards. The galaxy is full of the chips and splinters of the broken empire. The general swarm. Do you suppose the time may come when one will grow bold? Beta considered and shook her head decisively, so that the long straight hair with the single inward curl at the end swirled about her ears. No, not a chance. There's not one of those generals who doesn't know that an attack on the Foundation is suicide. Vel Rios of the old empire was a better man than any of them, and he attacked with the resources of a galaxy and couldn't win against the Selden plan. Is there one general that doesn't know that? But what if we spur them on? Into where? Into an atomic furnace? With what could you possibly spur them? Well, there is one. A new one. In this past year or two, there has come word of a strange man whom they call the Mule. The Mule? She considered. Ever hear of him, Tori? Toran shook his head. She said, What about him? I don't know, but he wins victories at, they say, impossible odds. The rumors may be exaggerated, but it would be interesting in any case to become acquainted with him. Not every man with sufficient ability and sufficient ambition would believe in Harry Selden and his laws of psychohistory. We could encourage that disbelief. He might attack, and the Foundation would win. Yes, but not necessarily easily. It might be a crisis, and we could take advantage of such a crisis to force a compromise with the despots of the Foundation. At the worst, they would forget us long enough to enable us to plan farther. What do you think, Tori? Toran smiled feebly and pulled at a loose brown curl that fell over one eye. The way he describes it, it can't hurt. But who is the Mule? What do you know of him, Randu? Nothing yet. For that, we could use you, Toran, and your wife, if she's willing. We've talked of this, your father and I. We've talked of this thoroughly. In what way, Randu? What do you want of us? The young man cast a quick, inquisitive look at his wife. Have you had a honeymoon? Well, yes, if you can call the trip from the Foundation a honeymoon. How about a better one on Kalgan? It's semi-tropical, beaches, water sports, bird hunting, quite the vacation spot. It's about 7,000 parsecs in, not too far. What's on Kalgan? The Mule. His men, at least. He took it last month, and without a battle, though Kalgan's warlord broadcast a threat to blow the planet to ionic dust before giving it up. Where's the warlord now? He isn't, said Randu with a shrug. What do you say? But what are we to do? I don't know. Fran and I are old. We're provincial. The traders of Haven are all essentially provincial. Even you say so. Our trading is of a very restricted sort, and we're not the galaxy roamers our ancestors were. Shut up, Fran. But you two know the galaxy. Beta, especially, speaks with a nice foundation accent. We merely wish whatever you can find out, if you can make contact. But we wouldn't expect that. Suppose you two think it over. You can meet our entire group if you wish. Oh, not before next week. You ought to have some time to catch your breath. There was a pause, and then Fran roared, Who wants another drink? I mean, besides me. Chapter 12. Captain and Mayor. Captain Han Pritcher was unused to the luxury of his surroundings, and by no means impressed. As a general thing, he discouraged self-analysis and all forms of philosophy and metaphysics not directly connected with his work. It helped. His work consisted largely of what the War Department called intelligence, the sophisticates, espionage, and the romanticists, spy stuff. And unfortunately, despite the frothy shrillness of the televisors, intelligence, espionage, and spy stuff are at best a sordid business of routine betrayed and bad faith. It is excused by society, since it is in the interest of the state, but since philosophy seemed always to lead Captain Pritcher to the conclusion that even in that holy interest, society is much more easily soothed than one's own conscience, he discouraged philosophy. And now, in the luxury of the mayor's anteroom, his thoughts turned inward despite himself. Men had been promoted over his head continuously, though of lesser ability. That much was admitted. He had withstood an eternal rain of black marks and official reprimands, and survived it. And stubbornly he had held to his own way in the firm belief that insubordination in that same holy interest of the state would yet be recognized for the service it was. So here he was in the anteroom of the mayor, with five soldiers as a respectful guard, and probably a court-martial awaiting him. The heavy marble doors rolled apart smoothly, silently, revealing satiny walls, a red plastic carpeting, and two more marble doors, metal inlaid, within. Two officials in the straight-lined costume of three centuries back stepped out and called, An audience to Captain Han Pritcher of Information. They stepped back with a ceremonious bow as the captain started forward. His escort stopped at the outer door, and he entered the inner alone. On the other side of the doors, in a large room strangely simple, behind a large desk strangely angular, sat a small man, almost lost in the immensity. Mayor Inber, successively the third of that name, was the grandson of the first Inber, who had been brutal and capable, and who had exhibited the first quality in spectacular fashion by his manner of seizing power, and the latter by the skill with which he put an end to the last farcical remnants of free election, and the even greater skill with which he maintained a relatively peaceful rule. Mayor Inber was also the son of the second Inber, who was the first mayor of the Foundation to succeed his post by right of birth, and who was only half his father, for he was merely brutal. So Mayor Inber was the third of the name, and the second to succeed by right of birth, and he was the least of the three, for he was neither brutal nor capable, but merely an excellent bookkeeper born wrong. Inber the third was a peculiar combination of ersatz characteristics to all but himself. To him, a stilted geometric love of arrangement was system, an indefatigable and feverish interest in the pettiest facets of day-to-day bureaucracy was industry, indecision when right was caution, and blind stubbornness when wrong, determination. And withal, he wasted no money, killed no man needlessly, and meant extremely well. If Captain Pritcher's gloomy thoughts ran along these lines as he remained respectfully in place before the large desk, the wooden arrangement of his features yielded no insight into the fact. He neither coughed, shifted weight, nor shuffled his feet until the thin face of the mayor lifted slowly, as the busy stylus ceased in its task of marginal notations, and a sheet of close-printed paper was lifted from one neat stack and placed upon another neat stack. Mayor Inber clasped his hands carefully before him, deliberately refraining from disturbing the careful arrangement of desk accessories. He said in acknowledgement, Captain Han Pritcher of Information. And Captain Pritcher, in strict obedience to protocol, bent one knee nearly to the ground and bowed his head until he heard the words of release. Arise, Captain Pritchard. The mayor said, with an air of warm sympathy, You are here, Captain Pritchard, because of certain disciplinary action taken against yourself by your superior officer. The papers concerning such action have come, in the ordinary course of events, to my notice, and since no event in the Foundation is of disinterest to me, I took the trouble to ask for further information on your case. You are not, I hope, surprised. Captain Pritchard said unemotionally, Excellence, no, your justice is proverbial. Is it? Is it? His tone was pleased, and the tinted contact lenses he wore caught the light in a manner that imparted a hard, dry gleam to his eyes. Meticulously, he fanned out a series of metal-bound folders before him. The parchment sheets within crackled sharply as he turned them, his long fingers following down the line as he spoke. I have your record here, Captain. Complete. You are 43 and have been an officer of the armed forces for 17 years. You were born in Loris, of Anacreonian parents, no serious childhood diseases, an attack of Mayo, well, that's of no importance. Education, pre-military, at the Academy of Sciences. Major, hyper-engines. Academic standing, very good. You're to be congratulated. Entered the army as under-officer on the 102nd day of the 293rd year of the Foundation era. He lifted his eyes momentarily as he shifted the first folder and opened the second. You see, he said, in my administration, nothing is left to chance. Order. System. He lifted a pink, scented jelly globule to his lips. It was his one vice, and but dolingly indulged in. Witness the fact that the mayor's desk lacked that almost inevitable atom flash for the disposal of dead tobacco, for the mayor did not smoke. Nor, as a matter of course, did his visitors. The mayor's voice droned on, methodically, slurringly, mumblingly, now and then interspersed with whispered comments of equally mild and equally ineffectual commendation or reproof. Slowly he replaced the folders as originally, in a neat single pile. Well, Captain, he said briskly, your record is unusual. Your ability is outstanding, it would seem, and your service is valuable beyond question. I note that you have been wounded in the line of duty twice, and that you have been awarded the Order of Merit for bravery beyond the call of duty. Those are facts not likely to be minimized. Captain Pritchard's expressionless face did not soften. He remained stiffly erect. Protocol required that a subject honored by an audience with the mayor may not sit down, a point perhaps needlessly reinforced by the fact that only one chair existed in the room, the one underneath the mayor. Protocol further required no statements other than those needed to answer a direct question. The mayor's eyes bore down hard upon the soldier, and his voice grew pointed and heavy. However, you have not been promoted in 10 years, and your superiors report over and over again of the unbending stubbornness of your character. You are reported to be chronically insubordinate, incapable of maintaining a correct attitude toward superior officers, apparently uninterested in maintaining frictionless relationships with your colleagues, and an incurable troublemaker besides. How do you explain that, Captain? Excellence, I do what seems right to me. My deeds on behalf of the state and my wounds in that cause bear witness that what seems right to me is also in the interest of the state. A soldierly statement, Captain, but a dangerous doctrine. More of that later. Specifically, you are charged with refusing an assignment 3 times in the face of orders signed by my legal delegates. What have you to say to that? Excellence, the assignment lacks significance in a critical time, where matters of first importance are being ignored. Ah, and who tells you these matters you speak of are of the first importance at all? And if they are, who tells you further that they are ignored? Excellence, these things are quite evident to me. My experience and my superior knowledge of events, the value of neither of which my superiors deny, make it plain. But, my good Captain, are you blind that you do not see that by arrogating to yourself the right to determine intelligence policy, you usurp the duties of your superior? Excellence, my duty is primarily to the state and not to my superior. Fallacious, for your superior has his superior, and that superior is myself, and I am the state. But come, you shall have no cause to complain of this justice of mine that you say is proverbial. State in your own words the nature of the breach in discipline that has brought all this on. Excellence, my duty is primarily to the state, and not to my living the life of a retired merchant mariner upon the world of Kalgan. My instructions were to direct Foundation activity upon the planet, perfect an organization to act as check upon the warlord of Kalgan, particularly as regards his foreign policy. This is known to me. Continue. Excellence, my reports have continually stressed the strategic positions of Kalgan and the systems it controls. I have reported on the ambition of the warlord, his resources, his determination to extend his domain, and his essential friendliness, or perhaps neutrality, towards the Foundation. I have read your reports thoroughly. Continue. Excellence, I returned 2 months ago. At that time, there was no sign of impending war, no sign of anything but an almost superfluity of ability to repel any conceivable attack. 1 month ago, an unknown soldier of fortune took Kalgan without a fight. The man who was once warlord of Kalgan is apparently no longer alive. Men do not speak of treason. They speak only of the power and genius of this strange Kantatayri, this mule. This who? The mayor leaned forward and looked offended. Excellence, he is known as the mule. He is spoken of little in a factual sense, but I have gathered the scraps and fragments of knowledge and winnowed out the most probable of them. He is apparently a man of neither birth nor standing, his father unknown, his mother dead in childbirth, his upbringing that of a vagabond, his education that of the tramp worlds and the backwash alleys of space. He has no name other than that of the mule, a name reportedly applied by himself to himself, and signifying, by popular explanation, his immense physical strength and stubbornness of purpose. What is his military strength, Captain? Never mind his physique. Excellence, men speak of huge fleets, but in this they may be influenced by the strange fall of Kalgan. The territory he controls is not large, though its exact limits are not capable of definite determination. Nevertheless, this man must be investigated. So. The mayor fell into a reverie, and slowly, with 24 strokes of his stylus, drew 6 squares in hexagonal arrangements upon the blank top sheet of a pad, which he tore off, folded neatly in 3 parts, and slipped into the waste paper slot at his right hand. It slid towards a clean and silent atomic disintegration. Now then, tell me, Captain, what is the alternative? You have told me what must be investigated. What have you been ordered to investigate? Excellence, there is a rat hole in space that, it seems, does not pay its taxes. Ah, and is that all? You are not aware, and have not been told, that these men who do not pay their taxes are descendants of the wild traders of our early days. Anarchists, rebels, social maniacs who claim Foundation ancestry and deride Foundation culture. You are not aware, and have not been told, that this rat hole in space is not one, but many. That these rat holes are in greater number than we know. That these rat holes conspire together, one with the other, and all with the criminal elements that still exist throughout Foundation territory. Even here, Captain, even here. The mayor's momentary fire subsided quickly. You are not aware, Captain? Excellence, I have been told all this, but as servant of the state, I must serve faithfully, and he serves most faithfully who serves truth. Whatever the political implications of these dregs of the ancient traders, the warlords who have inherited the splinters of the old empire have the power. The traders have neither arms nor resources. They have not even unity. I am not a tax collector to be sent on a child's errand. Captain Pritcher, you are a soldier and count guns. It is a failing to be allowed you up to the point where it involves disobedience to myself. Take care. My justice is not simply weakness. Captain, it has already been proven that the generals of the Imperial Age and the warlords of this present age are equally impotent against us. Selden's science, which predicts the course of the Foundation, is based not on individual heroism, as you seem to believe, but on the social and economic trends of history. We have passed successfully through 4 crises already, have we not? Excellence, we have. Yet Selden's science is known only to Selden. We ourselves have but faith. In the first 3 crises, as I have been carefully taught, the Foundation was led by wise leaders who foresaw the nature of the crises and took the proper precautions. Otherwise, who can say? Yes, Captain, but you omit the 4th crisis. Come, Captain, we had no leadership worthy of the name then, and we faced the cleverest opponent, the heaviest armor, the strongest force of all. Yet we won by the inevitability of history. Excellence, that is true. But this history you mention became inevitable only after we had fought desperately for over a year. The inevitable victory we won cost us 500,000 ships and 500,000 men. Excellence, Selden's plan helps those who help themselves. Mayor Indber frowned and grew suddenly tired of his patient exposition. It occurred to him that there was a fallacy in condescension, since it was mistaken for permission to argue eternally, to grow contentious, to wallow in dialectic. He said stiffly, "Nevertheless, Captain, Selden guarantees victory over the warlords, and I cannot, in these busy times, indulge in a dispersal of effort. These traitors you dismiss are foundation-derived. A war with them would be a civil war. Selden's plan makes no guarantee there for us, since they and we are foundation. So they must be brought to heel. You have your orders. Excellence, you have been asked no question, Captain. You have your orders. You will obey those orders. Further argument of any sort with myself or those representing myself will be considered treason. You are excused." Captain Han Pritchard knelt once more, then left with slow, backward steps. Mayor Indber, third of his name, and second mayor of Foundation history to be so by right of birth, recovered his equilibrium and lifted another sheet of paper from the neat stack at his left. It was a report on the saving of funds due to the reduction of the quantity of metal foam edging on the uniforms of the police force. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette. Mayor Indber crossed out a superfluous comma, corrected a misspelling, made three marginal notations, and placed it upon the neat stack at his right. He lifted another sheet of paper from the neat stack at his left. Captain Han Pritchard of Information found a personal capsule waiting for him when he returned to barracks. It contained orders, terse and redly underlined with a stamped urgent across it, and the whole initialed with a precise capital I. Captain Han Pritchard was ordered to the rebel world called Haven in the strongest terms. Captain Han Pritchard, alone in his light one-man speedster, set his course quietly and calmly for Calgan. He slept that night, the sleep of a successfully stubborn man. Chapter 13. Lieutenant and Clown. If from a distance of 7,000 parsecs, the fall of Calgan to the armies of the Mule had produced reverberations that had excited the curiosity of an old trader, the apprehension of a dogged captain, and the annoyance of a meticulous mayor, to those on Calgan itself, it produced nothing and excited no one. It is the invariable lesson to humanity that distance in time, and in space as well, lends focus. It is not recorded, incidentally, that the lesson has ever been permanently learned. Calgan was... Calgan. It alone, of all that quadrant of the galaxy, seemed not to know that the Empire had fallen, that the Stannels no longer ruled, that greatness had departed, and peace had disappeared. Calgan was the luxury world. With the edifice of mankind crumbling, it maintained its integrity as a producer of pleasure, a buyer of gold, and a seller of leisure. It escaped the harsher vicissitudes of history, for what conqueror would destroy, or even seriously damage, a world so full of the ready cash that would buy immunity? Yet even Calgan had finally become the headquarters of a warlord, and its softness had been tempered to the exigencies of war. Its tame jungles, its mildly mottled shores, and its garishly glamorous cities echoed to the march of imported mercenaries and impressed citizens. The worlds of its province had been armed, and its money invested in battleships, rather than bribes for the first time in its history. Its ruler proved beyond doubt that he was determined to defend what was his, and eager to seize what was others. He was a great one of the galaxy, a war and peacemaker, a builder of empire, an establisher of dynasty. And an unknown with a ridiculous nickname had taken him, and his arms, and his budding empire, and had not even fought a battle. So Calgan was as before, and its uniformed citizens hurried back to their older life, while the foreign professionals of war merged easily into the newer bands that descended. Again, as always, there were the elaborate luxury hunts for the cultivated animal life of the jungles that never took human life, and the speedster bird chases in the air above that was fatal only to the great birds. In the cities, the escapers of the galaxy could take their varieties of pleasure to suit their purse, from the ethereal sky palaces of spectacle and fantasy that opened their doors to the masses at the jingle of half a credit, to the unmarked, unnoted haunts to which only those of great wealth were of the cognoscenti. To the vast flood, Toran and Beta added not even a trickle. They registered their ship in the huge common hangar on the East Peninsula and gravitated to that compromise of the middle classes, the inland sea, where the pleasures were yet legal and even respectable, and the crowds were not yet beyond endurance. Beta wore dark glasses against the light and a thin white robe against the heat. Warm-tinted arms, scarcely the goldener for the sun, clasped her knees to her, and she stared with firm, abstracted gaze at the length of her husband's outstretched body, almost shimmering in the brilliance of white sun splendor. "Don't overdo it," she had said at first, but Toran was of a dying red star. Despite 3 years of the Foundation, sunlight was a luxury, and for 4 days now his skin, treated beforehand for ray resistance, had not felt the harshness of clothing, except for the brief shorts. Beta huddled close to him on the sand, and they spoke in whispers. Toran's voice was gloomy, as it drifted upwards from a relaxed face. "No, I admit we're nowhere. But where is he? Who is he? This mad world says nothing of him. Perhaps he doesn't exist." "He exists," replied Beta, with lips that didn't move. "He's clever, that's all. And your uncle is right. He's a man we could use, if there's time." A short pause. Toran whispered, "Know what I've been doing, Bay? I'm just daydreaming myself into a sun stupor. Things figure themselves out so neatly, so sweetly." His voice nearly trailed off, then returned. "Remember the way Dr. Amon talked back at College Bay? The Foundation can never lose, but that does not mean the rulers of the Foundation can't. Didn't the real history of the Foundation begin when Salvor Hardin kicked out the encyclopedists and took over the planet Terminus as the first mayor? And then in the next century, didn't Hober Mallow gain power by methods almost as drastic? That's twice the rulers were defeated, so it can be done. So why not by us? It's the oldest argument in the book, Tori. What a waste of good reverie. Is it? Follow it out. What's Haven? Isn't it part of the Foundation? It's simply part of the external proletariat, so to speak. If we become top dog, it's still the Foundation winning, and only the current rulers losing. Lots of difference between we can and we will. You're just jabbering." Toran squirmed. "Nuts, Bay, you're just in one of your sour green moods. What do you want to spoil my fun for? I'll just go to sleep if you don't mind." But Beta was craning her head, and suddenly, quite a non sequitur, she giggled and removed her glasses to look down the beach with only her palm shading her eyes. Toran looked up, then lifted and twisted his shoulders to follow her glance. Apparently she was watching a spindly figure, feet in air, who teetered on his hands for the amusement of a haphazard crowd. It was one of the swarming acrobatic beggars of the shore, whose supple joints bent and snapped for the sake of the thrown coins. A beach guard was motioning him on his way, and with a surprising one-handed balance, the clown brought a thumb to his nose in an upside-down gesture. The guard advanced threateningly and reeled backward with a foot in his stomach. The clown righted himself without interrupting the motion of the initial kick and was away, while the frothing guard was held off by a thoroughly unsympathetic crowd. The clown made his way raggedly down the beach. He brushed past many, hesitated often, stopped nowhere. The original crowd had dispersed. The guard had departed. "He's a queer fellow," said Beta with amusement, and Toran agreed indifferently. The clown was close enough now to be seen clearly. His thin face drew together in front into a nose of generous planes and fleshy tip that seemed all but prehensile. His long, lean limbs and spidery body, accentuated by his costume, moved easily and with grace, but with just a suggestion of having been thrown together at random. To look was to smile. The clown seemed suddenly aware of their regard, for he stopped after he had passed and, with a sharp turn, approached. His large brown eyes fastened upon Beta. She found herself disconcerted. The clown smiled, but it only saddened his beaked face, and when he spoke, it was with the soft, elaborate phrasing of the central sectors. "Were I to use the wits the good spirits gave me," he said, "then I would say this lady cannot exist. For what sane man would hold a dream to be reality? Yet rather would I not be sane and lend belief to charmed, enchanted eyes." Beta's own eyes opened wide. She said, "Wow." Taran laughed. "Oh, you enchantress. Go ahead, Bay. That deserves a 5-credit piece. Let him have it." But the clown was forward with a jump. "No, my lady, mistake me not. I spoke for money not at all, but for bright eyes and sweet face." "Well, thanks." Then to Toran, "Golly, you think the sun's in his eyes?" "Yet not alone for eyes and face," babbled the clown, as his words hurled past each other in heightened frenzy, "but also for a mind clear and sturdy, and kind as well." Toran rose to his feet, reached for the white robe he had crooked his arm about for 4 days, and slipped into it. "Now, Bud," he said, "suppose you tell me what you want, and stop annoying the lady." The clown fell back a frightened step, his meager body cringing. "Now, sure, I meant no harm. I am a stranger here, and it's been said I'm of addled wits. Yet there is something in a face that I can read. Behind this lady's fairness, there is a heart that's kind, and that would help me in my trouble for all I speak so boldly." "Will 5 credits cure your trouble?" said Toran dryly, and held out the coin. But the clown did not move to take it, and Beta said, "Let me talk to him, Tori." She added swiftly, and in an undertone, "There's no use being annoyed at his silly way of talking. That's just his dialect, and our speech is probably as strange to him." She said, "What is your trouble? You're not worried about the guard, are you? He won't bother you." "Oh, no, not he. He's but a windlet that blows the dust about my ankles. There is another that I flee, and he is a storm that sweeps the worlds aside and throws them plunging at each other. A week ago I ran away, have slept in city streets, and hid in city crowds. I've looked in many faces for help in need. I find it here." He repeated the last phrase in softer, anxious tones, and his large eyes were troubled. "I find it here." "Now," said Beta reasonably, "I would like to help, but really, friend, I'm no protection against a world-sweeping storm. To be truthful about it, I could use..." There was an uplifted, powerful voice that bore down upon them. "Now then, you mud-spawned rascal!" It was the beach guard, with a fire-red face and snarling mouth, that approached at a run. He pointed with his low-power stun pistol. "Hold him, you two! Don't let him get away!" His heavy hand fell upon the clown's thin shoulder, so that a whimper was squeezed out of him. Toran said, "What's he done?" "What's he done? What's he done? Well, now that's good." The guard reached inside the dangling pocket attached to his belt and removed a purple handkerchief, with which he mopped his bare neck. He said with relish, "I'll tell you what he's done. He's run away. The word's all over Calgan, and I would have recognized him before this if he had been on his feet instead of on his hawk-faced top." And he rattled his prey in a fierce good humor. Beta said with a smile, "Now where did he escape from, sir?" The guard raised his voice. A crowd was gathering, pop-eyed and jabbering, and with the increase of audience, the guard's sense of importance increased in direct ratio. "Where did he escape from?" he declaimed in high sarcasm. "Why, I suppose you've heard of the mule now?" All jabbering stopped, and Beta felt a sudden iciness trickle down into her stomach. The clown had eyes only for her. He still quivered in the guard's brawny grasp. "And who," continued the guard heavily, "would this infernal ragged piece be but his lordship's own court fool who's run away?" He jarred his captive with a massive shake. "Do you admit it, fool?" There was only white fear for answer, and the soundless sibilance of Beta's voice close to Toran's ear. Toran stepped forward to the guard in friendly fashion. "Now, my man, suppose you take your hand away for just a while. This entertainer you hold has been dancing for us, and has not yet danced out his fee." "Here!" the guard's voice rose in sudden concern. "There's a reward! You'll have it, if you can prove he's the man you want. Suppose you withdraw till then. You know that you're interfering with a guest, which could be serious for you." "But you're interfering with his lordship, and that will be serious for you!" He shook the clown once again. "Return the man's fee, carrion!" Toran's hand moved quickly, and the guard's stun pistol was wrenched away, with half a finger nearly following it. The guard howled his pain and rage. Toran shoved him violently aside, and the clown, unhanded, scuttled behind him. The crowd, whose fringes were now lost to the eye, paid little attention to the latest development. There was among them a craning of necks and a centrifugal motion, as if many had decided to increase their distance from the center of activity. Then there was a bustle and a rough order in the distance. A corridor formed itself, and two men strode through, electric whips in careless readiness. Upon each purple blouse was designed an angular shaft of lightning with a splitting planet underneath. A dark giant in lieutenant's uniform followed them, dark of skin and hair, and scowl. The dark man spoke with the dangerous softness that meant he had little need of shouting to enforce his whims. He said, "Are you the man who notified us?" The guard was still holding his wrenched hand, and with a pain-distorted face mumbled, "I claim the reward, Your Mightiness, and I accuse that man..." "You'll get your reward," said the lieutenant, without looking at him. He motioned curtly to his men. "Take him." Toran felt the clown tearing at his robe with a maddened grip. He raised his voice and kept it from shaking. "I'm sorry, Lieutenant. This man is mine." The soldiers took the statement without blinking. One raised his whip casually, but the lieutenant's snapped order brought it down. His dark mightiness swung forward and planted his square body before Toran. "Who are you?" And the answer rang out. "A citizen of the Foundation." It worked, with the crowd at any rate. The pent-up silence broke into an intense hum. The mule's name might excite fear, but it was, after all, a new name, and scarcely stuck as deeply in the vitals as the old one of the Foundation, that had destroyed the Empire, and the fear of which ruled a quadrant of the galaxy with ruthless despotism. The lieutenant kept face. He said, "Are you aware of the identity of the man behind you? I have been told he's a runaway from the court of your leader, but my only sure knowledge is that he's a friend of mine. You'll need firm proof of his identity to take him." There were high-pitched sighs from the crowd, but the lieutenant let it pass. "Have you your papers of Foundation citizenship with you?" "At my ship." "You realize that your actions are illegal. I can have you shot." "Undoubtedly, but then you would have shot a Foundation citizen, and it is quite likely that your body would be sent to the Foundation, quartered, as part compensation. It's been done by other warlords." The lieutenant wet his lips. The statement was true. He said, "Your name?" Toran followed up his advantage. "I will answer further questions at my ship. You can get the cell number at the hangar. It is registered under the name Beta." "You won't give up the runaway?" "To the mule, perhaps. Send your master." The conversation had degenerated to a whisper, and the lieutenant turned sharply away. "Disperse the crowd," he said to his men, with suppressed ferocity. The electric whips rose and fell. There were shrieks and a vast surge of separation and flight. Toran interrupted his reverie only once on their way back to the hangar. He said almost to himself, "Galaxy Bay, what a time I had. I was so scared." "Yes," she said, with a voice that still shook, and eyes that still showed something akin to worship. "It was quite out of character. Well, I still don't know what happened. I just got up there with a stun pistol that I wasn't even sure I knew how to use, and I talked back to him. I don't know why I did it." He looked across the aisle of the short-run air vessel that was carrying them out of the bench area, to the seat on which the mule's clown scrunched up in sleep, and added distastefully, "It was the hardest thing I've ever done." The lieutenant stood respectfully before the colonel of the garrison, and the colonel looked at him and said, "Well done. Your part's over now." But the lieutenant did not retire immediately. He said darkly, "The mule has lost face before a mob, sir. It will be necessary to undertake disciplinary action to restore proper atmosphere of respect. Those measures have already been taken." The lieutenant half turned then, almost with resentment. "I'm willing to agree, sir, that orders are orders. But standing before that man with his stun pistol and swallowing his insolence whole was the hardest thing I've ever done." Chapter 14. The Mutant. The hangar on Kalgan is an institution peculiar unto itself, born of the need for the disposition of the vast number of ships brought in by the visitors from abroad, and the simultaneous and consequent vast need for living accommodations for the same. The original bright one, who had thought of the obvious solution, had quickly become a millionaire. His heirs, by birth or finance, were easily among the richest on Calgan. The hangar spreads flatly over square miles of territory, and hangar does not describe it at all sufficiently. It is essentially a hotel for ships. The traveler pays in advance, and his ship is awarded a berth from which it can take off into space at any desired moment. The visitor then lives in his ship as always. The ordinary hotel services, such as the replacement of food and medical supplies at special rates, simple servicing of the ship itself, special intra-Calgan transportation for a nominal sum, are to be had, of course. As a result, the visitor combines hangar space and hotel bill into one, at a saving. The owners sell temporary use of ground space at ample profits. The government collects huge taxes. Everyone has fun. Nobody loses. Simple. The man who made his way down the shadow borders of the wide corridors that connected the multitudinous wings of the hangar had in the past speculated on the novelty and usefulness of the system described above. But these were reflections for idle moments, distinctly unsuitable at present. The ships hulked in their height and breadth down the long lines of carefully aligned cells, and the man discarded line after line. He was an expert at what he was doing now, and if his preliminary study of the hangar registry had failed to give specific information beyond the doubtful indication of a specific wing, one containing hundreds of ships, his specialized knowledge could winnow those hundreds into one. There was the ghost of a sigh in the silence as the man stopped and faded down one of the lines, a crawling insect beneath the notice of the arrogant metal monsters that rested there. Here and there, the sparkling of light from a porthole would indicate the presence of an early returner from the organized pleasures to simpler or more private pleasures of his own. The man halted and would have smiled if he ever smiled. Certainly the convolutions of his brain performed the mental equivalent of a smile. The ship he stopped at was sleek and obviously fast. The peculiarity of its design was what he wanted. It was not a usual model, and these days most of the ships of this quadrant of the galaxy either imitated Foundation design or were built by Foundation technicians. But this was special. This was a Foundation ship, if only because of the tiny bulges in the skin that were the nodes of the protective screen that only a Foundation ship could possess. There were other indications, too. The man felt no hesitation. The electronic barrier strung across the line of the ships as a concession to privacy on the part of the management was not at all important to him. It parted easily and without activating the alarm at the use of the very special neutralizing force he had at his disposal. So the first knowledge within the ship of the intruder without was the casual and almost friendly signal of the muted buzzer in the ship's living room. That was the result of a palm placed over the little photocell just one side of the main airlock. And while that successful search went on, Taran and Beta felt only the most precarious security within the steel walls of the Beta. The mule's clown, who had reported that within his narrow compass of body he held the lordly name of Magnifico Giganticus, sat hunched over the table and gobbled at the food set before him. His sad brown eyes lifted from his meal only to follow Beta's movements in the combined kitchen and larder where he ate. "The thanks of a weak one are of but little value," he muttered. "But you have them, for truly in this past week little but scraps have come my way. And for all my body is small, yet is my appetite unseemly great." "Well then, eat," said Beta with a smile. "Don't waste your time on thanks. Isn't there a central galaxy proverb about gratitude that I once heard?" "Truly there is, my lady. For a wise man, I have been told, once said, 'Gratitude is best and most effective when it does not evaporate itself in empty phrases.' But alas, my lady, I am but a mass of empty phrases, it would seem. When my empty phrases pleased the mule, it brought me a court dress and a grand name. For see you, it was originally simply Bobo, one that pleases him not. And then when my empty phrases pleased him not, it would bring upon my poor bones beatings and whippings." Taran entered from the pilot room. "Nothing to do now but wait, Bay. I hope the mule is capable of understanding that a Foundation ship is Foundation territory." Magnifico Giganticus, once Bobo, opened his eyes wide and exclaimed, "How great is the Foundation before which even the cruel servants of the mule tremble!" "Have you heard of the Foundation, too?" asked Beta with a little smile. "And who has not?" Magnifico's voice was a mysterious whisper. There are those who say it is a world of great magic, of fires that can consume planets, and secrets of mighty strength. They say that not the highest nobility of the galaxy could achieve the honor and deference considered only the natural due of a simple man who could say, I am a citizen of the Foundation, were he only a salvage miner of space, or a nothing like myself. Beta said, Now, Magnifico, you'll never finish if you make speeches. Here, I'll get you a little flavored milk. It's good. She placed a pitcher of it upon the table and motioned Toran out of the room. Tori, what are we going to do now? About him? She motioned towards the kitchen. How do you mean? If the mule comes, are we going to give him up? What else, Bay? He sounded harassed, and the gesture with which he shoved back the moist curl upon his forehead testified to that. He continued impatiently, Before I came here, I had a sort of vague idea that all we had to do was ask for the mule, and then get down to business. Just business, you know, nothing definite. I know what you mean, Tori. I wasn't much hoping to see the mule myself, but I did think we could pick up some first-hand knowledge of the mess, and then pass it over to people who know a little more about this interstellar intrigue. I'm no storybook spy. You're not behind me, Bay. He folded his arms and frowned. What a situation. You'd never know there was a person like the mule except for this last queer break. Do you suppose he'll come for his clown? Beta looked up at him. I don't know that I want him to. I don't know what to say or do. Do you? The inner buzzer sounded with its intermittent burring noise. Beta's lips moved wordlessly. The mule. Magnifico was in the doorway, eyes wide, his voice a whimper. The mule? Toran murmured, I've got to let him in. A contact opened the airlock, and the outer door closed behind the newcomer. The scanner showed only a single shadowed figure. It's only one person, said Toran with open relief, and his voice was almost shaky as he bent toward the signal tube. Who are you? You'd better let me in and find out, hadn't you? The words came thinly out the receiver. I'll inform you that this is a Foundation ship, and consequently Foundation territory by international treaty. I know that. Come with your arms free or I'll shoot. I'm well armed. Done? Toran opened the inner door and closed contact on his blast pistol, thumb hovering over the pressure point. There was the sound of footsteps, and then the door swung open, and Magnifico cried out, It's not the mule! It's but a man! The man bowed to the clown somberly. Very accurate. I'm not the mule. He held his hands apart. I'm not armed, and I come on a peaceful errand. You might relax and put the blast pistol away. Your hand isn't steady enough for my peace of mind. Who are you? Asked Toran brusquely. I might ask you that, said the stranger coolly, since you are the one under false pretenses, not I. How so? You're the one who claims to be a Foundation citizen when there's not an authorized trader on the planet. That's not so. How would you know? Because I am a Foundation citizen, and have my papers to prove it. Where are yours? I think you'd better get out. I think not. If you know anything about Foundation methods, and despite your imposture, you might, you'd know that if I don't return alive to my ship at a specified time, there'll be a signal at the nearest Foundation headquarters. So I doubt if your weapons will have much effect, practically speaking. There was an irresolute silence, and then Beta said calmly, Put the blaster away, Toran, and take him at face value. He sounds like the real thing. Thank you, said the stranger. Toran put his gun on the chair beside him. Suppose you explain all this now? The stranger remained standing. He was long of bone and large of limb. His face consisted of hard, flat planes, and it was somehow evident that he never smiled. But his eyes lacked hardness. He said, News travels quickly, especially when it is apparently beyond belief. I don't suppose there's a person on Kalgan who doesn't know that the mule's men were kicked in the teeth today by two tourists from the Foundation. I knew of the important details before evening, and as I said, there are no Foundation tourists aside from myself on the planet. We know about these things. Who are the we? We are... We. Myself, for one. I knew you were at the hangar. You had been overheard to say so. I had my ways of checking the registry, and my ways of finding the ship. He turned to Beta suddenly. You're from the Foundation. By birth, aren't you? Am I? This book is continued on cassette number 5. You're a member of the Democratic opposition. They call it the underground. I don't remember your name, but I do the face. You got out only recently, and wouldn't have if you were more important. Beta shrugged. You know a lot. I do. You escaped with a man. That one? Does it matter what I say? No. I merely want a thorough mutual understanding. I believe that the password during the week you left so hastily was Selden, Hardin, and Freedom. Porphyrat Hart was your section leader. Where'd you get that? Beta was suddenly fierce. Did the police get him? Taran held her back, but she shook herself loose and advanced. The man from the Foundation said quietly, Nobody has him. It's just that the underground spreads widely and in queer places. I'm Captain Han Pritcher of Information, and I'm a section leader myself. Never mind under what name. He waited, then said, No, you don't have to believe me. In our business, it is better to overdo suspicion than the opposite. But I'd better get past the preliminaries. Yes, said Toran. Suppose you do. May I sit down? Thanks. Captain Pritchard swung a long leg across his knee and let an arm swing loose over the back of the chair. I'll start out by saying that I don't know what all this is about, from your angle. You two aren't from the Foundation, but it's not a hard guess that you're from one of the independent trading worlds. That doesn't bother me over much. But out of curiosity, what do you want with that fellow, that clown you snatched to safety? You're risking your life to hold on to him. I can't tell you that. Well, I didn't think you would. But if you're waiting for the mule himself to come behind a fanfare of horns, drums, and electric organs, relax. The mule doesn't work that way. What? It came from both Taran and Beta, and in the corner, where Magnifico lurked with ears almost visibly expanded, there was a sudden joyful start. That's right. I've been trying to contact him myself, and doing a rather more thorough job of it than you two amateurs can. It won't work. The man makes no personal appearances, does not allow himself to be photographed or simulated, and is seen only by his most intimate associates. Is that supposed to explain your interest in us, Captain? Questioned Toran. No. That clown is the key. That clown is one of the very few that have seen him. I want him. He may be the proof I need, and I need something. Galaxy knows, to awaken the Foundation. It needs awakening, broke in Beta with sudden sharpness. Against what? And in what role do you act as alarm? That of rebel Democrat, or of secret police and provocateur? The captain's face set in its hard lines. When the entire Foundation is threatened, Madame Revolutionary, both Democrats and tyrants perish. Let us save the tyrants from a greater, that we may overthrow them in their turn. Who's the greater tyrant you speak of? Flared Beta. The mule. I know a bit about him, enough to have been my death several times over already, if I had moved less nimbly. Send the clown out of the room. This will require privacy. Magnifico, said Beta, with a gesture, and the clown left without a sound. The captain's voice was grave and intense, and low enough so that Toran and Beta drew close. He said, The mule is a shrewd operator, far too shrewd not to realize the advantage of the magnetism and glamour of personal leadership. If he gives that up, it's for a reason. That reason must be the fact that personal contact would reveal something that is of overwhelming importance not to reveal. He waved aside questions and continued more quickly. I went back to his birthplace for this and questioned people who for their knowledge will not live long. Few enough are still alive. They remember the baby born 30 years before, the death of his mother, his strange youth. The mule is not a human being. And his two listeners drew back in horror at the misty implications. Neither understood, fully or clearly, but the menace of the phrase was definite. The captain continued. He is a mutant, and obviously from his subsequent career, a highly successful one. I don't know his powers, or the exact extent to which he is what our thrillers would call a Superman, but the rise from nothing to the conqueror of Kalgan's warlord in 2 years is revealing. You see, don't you, the danger? Can a genetic accident of unpredictable biological properties be taken into account in the Selden plan? Slowly, Beta spoke. I don't believe it. This is some sort of complicated trickery. Why didn't the mule's men kill us when they could have, if he's a Superman? I told you that I don't know the extent of his mutation. He may not be ready yet for the Foundation, and it would be a sign of the greatest wisdom to resist provocation until ready. Suppose you let me speak to the clown. The captain faced the trembling Magnifico, who obviously distrusted this huge, hard man who faced him. The captain began slowly. Have you seen the mule with your own eyes? I have but too well, respected sir, and felt the weight of his arm with my own body as well. I have no doubt of that. Can you describe him? It is frightening to recall him, respected sir. He is a man of mighty frame. Against him, even you would be but a spindling. His hair is of a burning crimson, and with all my strength and weight, I could not pull down his arm once extended, not a hair's thickness. Magnifico's thinness seemed to collapse upon itself in a huddle of arms and legs. Often, to amuse his generals or to amuse only himself, he would suspend me by one finger in my belt from a fearful height while I chattered poetry. It was only after the 20th verse that I was withdrawn, and each improvised and each a perfect rhyme, or else start over. He is a man of overpowering might, respected sir, and cruel in the use of his power. And his eyes, respected sir, no one sees. What? What's that last? He wears spectacles, respected sir, of a curious nature. It is said that they are opaque, and that he sees by a powerful magic that far transcends human powers. I have heard, and his voice was small and mysterious, that to see his eyes is to see death, that he kills with his eyes, respected sir. Magnifico's eyes wheeled quickly from one watching face to another. He quavered, "It is true. As I live, it is true." Beta drew a long breath. "Sounds like you're right, Captain. Do you want to take over? Well, let's look at the situation. You don't owe anything here. The hangar's barrier above is free. I can leave any time." "Then leave. The mule may not wish to antagonize the Foundation, but he runs a frightful risk in letting Magnifico get away. It probably accounts for the hue and cry after the poor devil in the first place. So there may be ships waiting for you upstairs. If you're lost in space, who's to pin the crime?" "You're right," agreed Toran bleakly. "However, you've got a shield, and you're probably speedier than anything they've got. So as soon as you're clear of the atmosphere, make the circle in neutral to the other hemisphere. Then just cut a track outwards at top acceleration." "Yes," said Beta coldly. "And when we are back on the Foundation, what then, Captain?" "Why, you are then cooperative citizens of Kalgan, are you not? I know nothing to the contrary, do I?" Nothing was said. Toran turned to the controls. There was an imperceptible lurch. It was when Toran had left Kalgan sufficiently far in the rear to attempt his first interstellar jump that Captain Pritchard's face first creased slightly, for no ship of the Mule had in any way attempted to bar their leaving. "Looks like he's letting us carry off Magnifico," said Toran. "Not so good for your story." "Unless," corrected the captain, "he wants us to carry him off, in which case it's not so good for the Foundation." It was after the last jump, when within neutral flight distance of the Foundation, that the first ultra-wave news broadcast reached the ship. And there was one news item barely mentioned. It seemed that a warlord, unidentified by the board speaker, had made representations to the Foundation concerning the forceful abduction of a member of his court. The announcer went on to the sports news. Captain Pritchard said icily, "He's one step ahead of us after all." Thoughtfully, he added, "He's ready for the Foundation, and he uses this as an excuse for action. It makes things more difficult for us. We will have to act before we are really ready." Chapter 15. The Psychologist. There was reason to the fact that the element known as pure science was the freest form of life on the Foundation. In a galaxy where the predominance and even survival of the Foundation still rested upon the superiority of its technology, even despite its large access of physical power in the last century and a half, a certain immunity adhered to the scientist. He was needed, and he knew it. Likewise, there was reason to the fact that Ebling Miz, only those who did not know him added his titles to his name, was the freest form of life in the pure science of the Foundation. In a world where science was respected, he was the scientist, with capital letters and no smile. He was needed, and he knew it. And so it happened.